Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this Thanksgiving with Adele Stan, a journalist based in Washington who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics and is currently a columnist for The American Prospect. We'll discuss how much the pandering by Republican presidential candidates to a few thousand Christian fundamentalists in Iowa is having a detrimental effect on the national discourse and harming America's image overseas. With rampant Latino bashing and now Muslim bashing, along with ugly and inhumane references to rabid dogs and Nazi-like lists of people deemed different and less than human, we will look into what is happening to the heart and soul of America that appears to be being hardened with hate, with a lust for war, by those who profess to be the followers of the Prince of Peace, Jesus Christ. Then we'll explore the foreign policy arena in terms of the prescriptions and pronouncements by the Republican candidates running for the presidency and speak with Jacob Harbron, the senior editor of The National Interest and author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. We'll examine the amazing ignorance displayed by Dr. Ben Carson and the ludicrous amateurism of Donald Trump's simplistic solutions for global problems. And we'll also look ahead to the Republican convention, which Trump is likely to dominate, to determine whether there is a pathway to the nomination for Ted Cruz, who is more intelligent but just as belligerent as the frontrunners, or Marco Rubio, who is a captive of the neocons and Adelson's millions, and is perhaps the most dangerous candidate when it comes to running foreign policy. And joining us now on this Thanksgiving is Adele Stan, a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She is currently a columnist for The American Prospect, where she recently wrote the article, Is Ben Carson's Campaign About to Implode? Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And what I find particularly disturbing about the coarseness and the coarsening of our political discourse, particularly, we've had a lot of immigrant bashing and talking about building walls to keep Mexicans out, and now we're closing the door on Syrian refugees. And the particularly rabid responses are coming from the Republican presidential candidates, with Ben Carson referring to Syrian refugees as rabid dogs, and then you've got
Right. Then
you've got Donald Trump proposing a kind of Nazi-like list of people deemed different or less than human, the Untermenschen, as the Nazis call them. So my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is what's driving this in part, apart from the fact that these candidates themselves may be racists. What's driving this is that they're all pandering to the Christian fundamentalists in Iowa. Is that your understanding?
I think you're exactly right. Now, I think that the natural constituency of the GOP at this point nationwide is also inclined toward this sort of a view. But right now, everything is about Iowa. And indeed, this is kind of a very crass appeal to that that cohort in Iowa, the religious fundamentalist Christians, who comprise the majority of the caucus-going voters. So it's sort of ironic in view of Christianity is supposed to be sort of the champion of the of those in trouble, but yes, I think it's important to remember that a lot of what the GOP has staked its claim on is kind of a cultural identity movement, and the culture is white, church-going Christians.
Well, but that's where you have to ask yourself, well, is this Christianity? What's happened to Christianity? As you alluded to, the Prince of Peace, Jesus Christ, didn't hate homosexuals, didn't celebrate capital punishment,
right,
didn't tote an AK-47 and shake down poor people for money on television.
And he didn't go for stoning women for sexual impropriety either.
Right. But he also ministered to the poor, washed the feet mm-hmm. of lepers. And, you know, here we are shutting the door on the most vulnerable people on the planet, women and children in large part, escaping the very horror of the Islamic State that these reactions are in response to, their atrocities. So it just doesn't make any sense. And it really, I'm beginning to wonder what kind of America we are becoming.
Well, I think that's a thing to worry about. And I think you're quite right on that. No, it does not, you know, it's a total cognitive disconnect from, you know, the Sermon on the Mount to the reaction of these so-called Christians to the plight of the Syrian refugees. You're absolutely right about that. But, you know, fear has always been a great political motivator, especially on the right. And these guys are playing for keeps, right? So they're willing to pull out the stops in any way, by any means necessary, that gets them to where they want to be. And right now we have a very fearful American public, and fearful of all kinds of things, for which these attacks in Paris can simply be kind of a touchstone. You know, there's this fear, Ian, of America no longer being a majority, you know, Anglo-white country, right? The rising electorate of people who look different from or speak a different language from the people who have deem themselves the real Americans. You have an uncertain economy. You have all of these things where people are feeling displaced. The people who thought that they were, you know, the epitome of what it means to be an American. So I think that this is all a kind of a way of congealing, you know, that toxic fear into an electoral force.
And again, I'm speaking with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She is currently a columnist for The American Prospect, where she recently wrote the article, "Is Ben Carson's Campaign About to Implode?" And recently, Adele, at this UCLA Hammer Forum that I moderate here in Los Angeles, I had I had Barney Frank out to give us an assessment of what he thought the elections would be a year from the day we did it. Was on literally on election day.
I'm sure that was lively.
He's as smart as a tack and doesn't suffer fools. So he had me on my toes, I have to tell you. He's a tough guy. But in any case, he was basically, in a sort of somewhat joking way, was talking about how the Democratic Party basically is supported by women and the Republican Party by men, that men vote Republican and women vote Democrat in this country. And the statistics are pretty clear on that. And he said, frankly, the only white men that vote for Democrats are gays and Jews. So this leads me to the question, since you're talking about how the changing demographics in this country have caused the Republican sort of to put up these sort of Fort Apache walls and protect the endangered white man. Concurrently or coincidentally, a recent report came out that for the first time in the longest time, the death rate amongst white men, particularly working class white men, has gone up in this country. So this leads me to some basic questions. One is, what's happening to the white man in America? And two, why aren't the Democrats winning them over, or have they given up on them, or what's going on here? Because this is a constituency that may be reacting in a very confused, racist, hostile, inchoate way. But on the other hand, it is a constituency that probably needs help if the statistics about white men dying off in larger numbers.
Yes, well, that's a great question, isn't it, Ian? You know, on Sunday, Alec McGillis in the New York Times had a really fascinating opinion piece, a reported opinion piece called something like Why is My Blue State Turning Red? And he looked at the rate of voter participation among the most dispossessed among the rural whites and found that the people at the bottom rung, who are, including white men, are not voting. These are the people who should be a natural Democratic constituency, but they are not voting. And so they in places like Kentucky and Tennessee and West Virginia, so that kind of leaves the ground to the people who are the next rung up, who like to see themselves, you know, in contrast to those at the very bottom as being somewhat better. And he found that even folks that had pulled themselves out of poverty through government assistance, once they had gotten there and were voting and felt enfranchised, were voting for Republicans. Again, I think we do get to this notion of cultural identity, and we also get to this place where the Democrats have done a terrible job at organizing their, you know, people who would be their natural constituencies. And I think because of a very short-sighted electoral project, if you recall when Howard Dean led the Democratic National Committee, he began a project for a 50-state strategy. And he learned that, he assumed that that was the way to go, having watched the religious right organize. And then the party, the establishment part of the party apparatus said, no, that's a waste of resources because we're never going to win in places in the South. So why would we bother to organize? Well, if you say you're never going to win and you're not going to organize, that kind of guarantees you're never going to win now, doesn't it?
Right. Well, but this is a party, you know, largely, certainly in the Congress, led by women, Nancy Pelosi and Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I think
That's a good point.
And the deputy, who's fantastic, the Gabby from Hawaii, do you know her at all?
Yeah. I'm sorry, her full name is.
Escapes me too, but boy, She's a powerful addition to an otherwise...
And a veteran.
Yeah, exactly. So to this otherwise sort of directionless party. So what's your sense then of when you've got your recent piece in the American Prospect talks about Ben Carson's campaign about to implode? I think by now it's imploding. And I don't think, to begin with, that it was ever a serious campaign. I think it was entirely commercial, that he entered the race just like a lot of these people to up their lecture fees and promote their books, and that's pretty much the case with Huckabee and Santorum. There's no national, and Bobby Jindal, you know, what kind of national clamor is there for those people? You know, it's ridiculous. They're clearly trying to promote their brand, up their lecture fees and sell their books. But in Carson's case, he makes no bones about it. He actually took time off from his presidential campaign to sell books, and
right.
His business manager runs his campaign, Armstrong Williams. Mm-hmm. And I think probably they just got caught by surprise that they did so well. And now
I think that's right. And then they start to buy in the idea that they can win.
Right. And then they have to fill this guy's head with information. Apparently, he's incapable of processing information. He's a brilliant neurosurgeon, but he has no skills in the rest of the human activity. He's totally at a loss.
Well, I think that's quite true. I mean, you know, it's not uncommon for genius to be compartmentalized, you know. And he's clearly an example of that. But I think what's important about Carson and his candidacy is that it did that for the time that he was doing so well, and he's still, you know, on the record doing well, although he's losing support now in Iowa. The thing is that why did people come to him? Why was the clamor for him? And, you know, I think that truly, it had to do with not only his appeal to the socially conservative religious evangelicals, but also the fact that, you know, he's African American, but espousing the ideology of, you know, the party of the white guy. And it's a way for people to feel good about themselves, and they can say, well, look at me, I'm not a racist, you know, because I voted for Ben Carson. So I think that's a significant moment in Republican Party history to look at what that was about. And I am using the past tense because I just don't expect his candidacy to survive. I think Ted Cruz is going to pick up his followers.
Well, Adele, let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment continuing the conversation. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She's currently a columnist for The American Prospect, where she recently wrote the article, Is Ben Carson's Campaign About to Implode? And on this Thanksgiving, we're talking about the politics of the moment, and particularly the role of religion in politics, which is, I think, you know, shameful in the sense that rather than appealing to the better angels of our nature, the political discourse coming from the Republicans now is full of hate and a lust for war. And it is apparently, at least to my mind, and I think you agree with me, Adele, that this is coming from the pandering that's going on to this constituency of Christian fundamentalists in Iowa. It's always been odd that Iowa shapes the political direction of races in this country and New Hampshire, neither of which are in any way indicative of the broad American landscape. But that's the way it is. Do you have any thoughts on why it is that way? Because it does sort of stack the deck in an odd sort of right-wing fundamentalist way.
Indeed it does. And I think part of it is that the media, for one thing, the states are, you know, in the case of New Hampshire, it's a small state geographically, and it's easy for a candidate to get all over the place. I'm not quite sure what to make of Iowa in that sense. In both states, media are not expensive. So that's part of the equation, too. But, you know, I, as a native New Jerseyan, I've always argued, perhaps through, you know, my own chauvinism, that New Jersey would be the perfect first in the nation primary. It's practically a microcosm of the nation writ large in terms of all of its various constituencies and mix of industry and agriculture and the whole nine yards. Or Ohio would be another interesting bellwether in that regard. It has, you know, all the different constituencies. But, you know, in New Jersey, media don't come cheap because media you have to buy are New York and Philadelphia. So I think that, you know, it does kind of speak to, but beyond the issue of practical concerns in media and being able to traverse the state in short order, it goes back to this notion of who is a real American. And there's this romanticized idea of, you know, of the real American being someone who lives outside of cities. which is absurd. If you look at where our population are concentrated, right? There is a bias in the, you know, popular romantic imagination against urban people as real Americans.
Well, but that goes back to the founding fathers in the way that they gave these small rural states two senators, and the Electoral College, of course, favors that imbalance.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
So, but just to follow on with New Jersey and what we're talking about in terms of the influence of Iowa, and in particular the influence or the exaggerated influence of Christian fundamentalists on the American electoral system, because they're so present in Iowa, and now we have all these presidential campaigns pandering to them. Nobody is more shameful in their pandering to the Christians in Iowa than that corpulent creep, that blowhard, that hideous Governor Christie. I mean, I cannot believe how he's come out too, bashing Muslims, just a sort of me too. You know, I'm at the kids' table.
Absolutely.
I'm at the kids' table now, but, you know, listen to me and elevate me back to the main stage.
And he's from one of the most ethnically diverse states in the nation. I think there are 131 languages spoken in New Jersey. I mean, he is just the shame of New Jersey. And the thing that just galls me is how he represents himself as a Jersey guy, as if, you know, being obnoxiously prejudiced and being anti public education is somehow, you know, representative of, you know, our great little corrupt state. And and, you know, it's not who we are. He's got the accent. That's what he's got. He's got the accent, and he's got the bombast that is typical of folks from our state, and including myself. But he doesn't, what he's saying is not the kind of thing that normally flies in New Jersey, which is not to say that New Jersey isn't, you know, ruthlessly segregated and has all kinds of problems within the state itself in terms of ethnic tension and racial tension. But nonetheless, I mean, he is just, you're right, it's just a craven and crass appeal to try and move up to the grown-up table, as you say.
Well, at least in terms of the Soprano state, I think closing off that freeway bridge, which, of course, here's the guy that's appealing. I'm the best guy on national security because I'm a former prosecutor. You know, I know how to put these Arabs
in jail.
Well,
as my mother, who was born in Jersey City, said, what's he going to do, close a bridge?
Exactly. So, do we have anything to be thankful for in the political realm at this point? I mean, it's pretty obvious that the country's so polarized and so divided, and that the Democrats, thanks to these clowns that are running on the Republican side, will have an easy path, I think, with Hillary Clinton to the presidency.
Well, one can only hope. I mean, you don't know, you know, because the global situation is so volatile, and because the economy is still fragile. We really don't, I think it's really important for people not to be complacent about the Democrats' chances.
Well, but there's no reason to be complacent about the fact that it's unlikely that they'd win back the House. That's a terrible situation, and because of the Republicans got the jump on them at the census, Karl Rove, they've got the majority of the state houses and the majority of the governorships. So it's not like the Republicans are hurting on terms of both state houses and legislative branch. They've got the Senate. Democrats have a hard time even getting that back, and they don't have much of a chance of getting the House back. So
right.
They're, you know,
and that's going to be that way till at least 2020. Yeah. You know,
so that's
because of the census. Yeah.
So that's the sort of unfortunate situation in terms of the polarization of the country. And I don't see. I mean, when you say that some foreign actor could screw things up for the Democrats, that is a tradition here in this country. And for the life of me, I do not understand it. How do you explain the fact that the world's lone superpower, the most powerful nation in the history of man, continually gets whipsawed by obscure Middle Eastern actors who are absolutely, the proportionality is so absurd. Just think about it. A tortured Palestinian killed Bobby Kennedy over the sale of fighter jets to Israel. And that changed the political, that changed the entire political direction of this country and allowed Richard Nixon to become president instead of Bobby Kennedy. Then you had another obscure actor from Iran, this Ayatollah Khamenei, who came out of nowhere, this very dark medieval character. He decided that Ronald Reagan should be our next president. Right. Then you have Osama bin Laden, a cave-dwelling nutcase, who essentially certainly helped Bush Jr. get his second term. And now you've got these people that cut heads off on television, completely changing the political discourse. Now the superpower has to spend $607 billion a year on defense to chase after a bunch of Mad Max marauders running around in Toyota pickup trucks with their black flags in the middle of nowhere. Where's the proportionality? Why does the most powerful nation on the earth get whipsawed by these obscure actors?
Well, Ian, I think, you know, you and I might agree that it's our very, the very exercise of the muscularity of the U.S. that invites this sort of response, right? I mean, this sort of, if you go back through each of those examples that you just gave, let's start with Iran, right? Well, the U.S. deposed the democratically elected leader and installed the Shah, and the Shah was oppressive, and that made Khomeini look good. And, you know, that there you go. I mean, with Osama bin Laden, that grew, that movement grew out of the empowerment and arming of warlords in Afghanistan. And so there you had al-Qaeda grow with the help of the Taliban. And when you get to, you know, the further growth of al-Qaeda and ISIS or the Islamic State, whatever you want to call them, I mean, that couldn't have happened without this destruction of Iraq. So, you know, I mean, these and if you're you know, we've been shown time and time again how guerrilla movements can defeat, you know, great military power. I mean, you would think the U.S. had taken that lesson from Vietnam, but it doesn't. We don't. We need to flex those muscles and try to assert our will for reasons having to do with multinational trade and other things. And this is what happens. People, you know, that you create power vacuums, and they will be filled by people at the most extreme fringes.
Well, it's still, though, you have to, I think, accept the premise of my question or my puzzlement here is that we do not control our own political destiny. That is the record, and that's just incomprehensible to my mind. Now, in terms of the current situation, there's clearly two things, at least to my mind, that are driving this current agony in the Middle East, and that is the Saudi Arabians, who have radicalized Islam.
Yes, they have.
There's a very, very amazing piece in the New York Times op-ed, in the electronic version, not in the print version, on last Saturday, that I'll put on at ianmasters.com because it was such a good piece, really giving an analysis of what the Saudis really have done in terms of radicalizing the Islamic faith.
Yes, the Wahhabism.
Yeah. So that's one half of this toxic brew. The other half is our stupid foreign policy that's been creating failed states. You know, we created a failed state in Iraq, we created a failed state in Libya, and we're not responsible necessarily for the failed state in Syria, although we didn't do anything about it when we could have in the early stages. And we certainly have had our longest war in history involved in a failed state, Afghanistan, which after trillions of dollars spent, it's even more of a failed state. So we're essentially contributing to the breeding grounds in which these jihadis can operate. And then the Saudis, of course, are giving them the ideological and religious underpinning.
Yeah, well, this is that's exactly right. But it's, you know, it's also the same mentality that says, you know, you can stem the tide by of violence against the U.S. by locking out, you know, people who are fleeing beheadings and barrel bombs, you know, because might is right, and this land is our land only, and all of that is all of a piece, you know. It's that we have a world view that we exercise, and we refuse, if reality conflicts with the world view, we will stick with the world view. You know.
Right. Well, Adele, we're running out of time. I just wanted to have one quick last question, and it may take you a minute to think about it. We've only got a minute. What do you feel on this Thanksgiving Day that you have to be thankful for?
Well, there's so much to be thankful for. First of all, you know, just living in a country where, you know, we have so much to draw on in terms of resources and it's such a range of ideas and political thought. We forget about that because we think about what is dominating the news. But, you know, I'm grateful for the campaign of Bernie Sanders. I'm grateful that there's a discussion of what it means to be a socialist. I'm grateful that that people are beginning to explore why are rural white people who are disempowered not supporting programs that it would seem or politicians who would seem to be on their side. I'm grateful that we're having some real soul searching on the left, and that the left seems to be finding more of a voice. So I'm grateful for those things.
Well, Adele Stan, I thank you so much for joining us on this Thanksgiving.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She's currently a columnist for The American Prospect, where she recently wrote the article, "Is Ben Carson's Campaign About to Implode?" We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the prescriptions and pronouncements by the Republican candidates on foreign policy.
Until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jacob Halbron, who is a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for The Los Angeles Times, a senior editor at The New Republic, and a Japan Society Fellow. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob Halbron.
Thank you, Ian.
And on this Thanksgiving week, holiday, just to go back a little bit, there's been a clamor since the massacres in Paris by the presidential candidates to man up and get tough. A reporter even asked the president in a very crude way, in effect, it's time for him to man up and to go after those bastards, referring to Daesh, the Islamic State. You've got Jeb Bush speaking last week at the Citadel, talking about needing to put boots on the ground. And, of course, the neocon character that's also running for the presidency, Marco Rubio, has all kinds of plans, along with Ted Cruz, to get American boots on the ground and get into another war in the Middle East. So what's your sense of where the American people are on this? Because I understand polls indicate that there's a great reluctance to get dragged back into the Middle East. But at the same time, we appear to be, as a society, incredibly susceptible to images on television and having hostages having their heads cut off by the Islamic State.
Well, it's not surprising that the massacre in Paris would trigger anxiety in the United States, but we appear to be less vulnerable than Europe, which is dealing with homegrown terrorists. And our Muslim community has not displayed the same kind of attitudes that you find in Europe. So I think while you can never preclude an attack in the United States, we appear to be safer than what's taking place in Europe. So you have periodic spasms of anxiety in America, but I don't think that there's a groundswell for sending in troops. Jeb Bush is maybe the only candidate I've seen that really took that bellicose line.
Well, but there's a lot of talk now, though, of a clash of civilizations, which, of course, is the book by Samuel Huntington that the neocons seized on. And how much do you think that's coming back into the national security debate, particularly with all these, 34 governors last week closing the door on Syrian refugees?
Well, the governors really acted in a shameful way. That's just sheer hysteria. To call it a clash of civilizations is to grant too much authority to the Islamic State. I think the French President Hollande had it correct when he said they don't represent any civilization. They represent what we've seen before, a fanatical ideological force, similar. In this case, it's a religious one, but it does act on Leninist principles as well, the idea of a vanguard accelerating history. But their level of brutality and ferocity has also turned off many, many Muslims. I mean, I think it's an extremist fringe, but it's clearly because the United States toppled Saddam Hussein, and we took the lid off this region. Now we're seeing the meltdown.
Yeah, but nobody on the Republican side is taking responsibility, or even the brother of George W. Bush keeps ducking that responsibility. It's so clear where the fault lies.
But I think Rand Paul was pretty clear in the last debate. I mean, he did assign some blame to the United States for having created havoc in the region, in Syria and Iraq, that we essentially upended all of these regimes, and in Libya as well, where we took out Gaddafi.
Well, I was interested in getting your take on what's sort of guiding the foreign policy discussion on the Republican side. And I guess the most outrageous example of spectacular foreign policy ignorance has to be Dr. Ben Carson.
Yes, alleging that the Chinese are involved in the conflict in Syria. He would have been better off sticking to the medical profession than wading into politics. But let's not forget that the entire Republican debate has been highly irresponsible on foreign policy. There isn't a single candidate, apart from Paul, who is not attempting to resuscitate the neoconservative doctrines of unilateralism that originally took us to war in Iraq in 2003.
Again, I'm speaking with Jacob Halbron, who is a senior editor at the National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times, a senior editor at the New Republic, and a Japan Society fellow. But in the case of Dr. Ben Carson, he made some extraordinary remarks in an interview with Charlie Rose a while back. And then more recently, of course, it's been revealed that his chief foreign policy advisor is a former major general in the U.S. Army who's been the proselytizer-in-chief in the U.S. Army that was trying to convert every soldier to become a Christian soldier. And then he headed up, after he left the military, Military Ministries, whose function is to proselytize the military, who then will in turn convert the population of the United States and then the world, and then we can take on the Muslims in a new crusade. I mean, I'm not making stuff up here. And then, of course, the other advisor to Ben Carson accidentally told the truth to the New York Times recently, Dewey Claridge, the former CIA operative. And he basically said that dealing with Carson is pretty impossible because he doesn't retain one iota of information. But on the other hand, the idea that this Christian zealot and Dewey Claridge are filling up Carson's empty head is scary enough in itself.
Yeah, well, and Trump is no bed of roses either. You know, I mean, he's essentially announced that he would bomb the heck out of the Middle East to reach a resolution, and it's Trump who poured a lot of gasoline on the flames of the refusal to accept Syrian refugees into the United States when the number that we're accepting is already pitifully low. So there is clearly, you know, a lot of room for demagoguery on these issues. But I find it hard to believe that this isn't confined to a certain brand of Republican primary voter.
In the sense that what? The Iowa caucus being dominated by, on the Republican side, by the Christian right and evangelical?
Yeah. I mean, I think as it stands, the Republican Party could be heading towards an electoral disaster.
Well, not according to Ted Cruz, though. Ted Cruz says that the problem with the Republicans is that they tack to the center in the general, and they don't stick to their right-wing principles. And he made the case that there are 95 million evangelicals in the United States, and by extension, all you have to do is get them to vote. I don't know how and he ever came up with that figure, but what's your
understanding? This is right-wing mythology. It's the idea that if you're only conservative enough, then people will realize that you're right. It didn't work for Barry Goldwater in 1964. It took Ronald Reagan, a former adherent of the New Deal, to package conservative principles in a more inviting form with a smile to be able to sell them to the American public. There's no way that the kind of demagoguery that you're seeing from Trump or Cruz would go down well in a national election. The constituency simply doesn't exist for it.
Well, I have to say that Ted Cruz is not a demagoguery with a smile like Reagan. He's demagoguery with a scary kind of sneer. I mean, you know,
he reminds me of, and I'm not the only one, of Joe McCarthy.
Well, he's a certain physical resemblance, I agree. But the extent to which he's sort of now being considered by a lot of pundits as the default guy after the others drop out and Carson self-destructs and people get tired of Donald Trump's boorishness, that...
But among the Republican Party, why do you think that Trump couldn't get the nomination? They may not tire of Trump. They may, in fact, decide that he's a genuine article, and why go with a simulacrum in the form of Cruz?
Well, I've heard that argument. I've heard both arguments, because most people are suggesting that, and they've been suggesting it since day one, that this guy's going to eventually flame out or say something that will have crossed the line. But every time he says something outrageous, he goes up in the polls. So far, they've been proven wrong.
I mean, if Trump were to win Iowa and New Hampshire, he would be in a very commanding position.
So and what kind of odds do you give him then, Jacob?
I think his odds are pretty high. I mean, I'd say at least 50-50, maybe even 70%, because his support does not seem to go down. And if the other candidates cannibalize each other and he sticks at his 30 or 35%, then it could go all the way to the convention.
And where does Marco Rubio fit into the picture in your regard?
He seems like the most logical candidate for the Republican Party to run. because he has the immigrant story, he has a positive message, and he's a very smooth salesman.
And he's got Adelson and the big money behind him too, and of course he's got the neocons advising him on foreign policy.
That's correct. He's completely neocon, and any Republican candidate is going to be quite hawkish on foreign policy. The interesting thing about Trump is that he has welcomed the intervention of Russia in the Middle East. So in some ways, Trump does not conform to the traditional conservative narrative.
Well, he also committed the heresy of going after a fellow Republican and by pointing out what a disaster George W. Bush's foreign policy was in Iraq in particular, and in allowing, in effect, 9/11 to happen by ignoring all of the warnings.
And he's called, you know, he's not immune to tax hikes either, and he's talking about income inequality. I think Trump would be a mortal blow to traditional republicanism, and he might well tack to the left in a general election.
Well, then I take it that there's a good chance. You can't deny it. I mean, he's ahead, and if anybody's self-destructing at this moment, it would seem to be Ben Carson, would you think? I mean,
I think Trump is a much more effective puncher than Carson. He really knows how to go for the jugular and get the crowds going.
Right. But I think that the more that Carson's exposed to the disinfectant of sunlight, the more absolutely absurd his ideas are and reckless and dangerous his foreign policy prescriptions are. So I think that's bound to eventually... my suspicion is he never thought he could really get this far, that he and his partner, Armstrong Williams, are basically into the brand of Carson, selling books and upping his lecture fee. This has never struck me as a serious... In fact, it may well be a kind of cynical effort to make money and use the presidential platform as a way to raise your profile. And that being the case, I think he's probably just completely surprised that he's gone as far as he has.
Yeah, it is quite amazing. But, of course, they haven't gone anywhere until the first primaries are held. So right now, it's obviously all speculation. But it still does seem that partly because of its hatred for Obama, the Republican base, is a roiling mass of seething hatreds. And the candidates that can best express them will rise to the top.
And I guess your theory then is that, but this is not going to work in the general?
No, I think it's a total recipe for disaster, because Dan Greenberg had a column in the Washington Post recently too, pointing out just how much the electorate has changed. The growing number of Hispanic voters in Virginia as well, not just in Texas and the other states. There's no way that the Republican Party can sell this brand in a national election. There's one way is if we had a major terrorist attack inside the United States and they were able to convince people that the Democrats are unable to keep America safe. That might be enough to tip the scales. But otherwise, I don't see any avenue.
And on the Democratic side, it's sort of doesn't even look like a race to me.
I don't think it will be. I think Sanders serves as a useful foil for Clinton. She can present herself as a moderate candidate and allow him to stoke the base. And I think Sanders will be an effective campaigner for Clinton in the general election and will push the party platform, and Clinton herself will nudge her to the left. But I think there's no one with Clinton's discipline and experience that can seriously challenge her. I think it's a problem for the Republicans too, because she's been under fire and she's weathered it. So I don't think there's anything that can be thrown at her that will cause her to stumble or surprise her in the general election. Her big trouble is self-inflicted wounds.
Right, but your point is reinforced, Jacob Halperin, by those ridiculous Benghazi hearings. After 13.8 hours of being grilled by those, you know, junkyard dogs just yapping at her over the most trivial nonsense, she just went way up in the polls.
Yeah, because one of the dilemmas for the Republicans will be that she is also a woman, so they have to tread carefully there. And she is very composed. I'm quite sanguine about her prospects in the general election, I have to say. Also, the fact that she doesn't face serious competition in the primaries means that she can focus on the general election and will have tremendous fundraising, whereas the Republicans will be bloodying each other. I mean, if you look at the ferocity with which the Republicans are attacking each other now, it's quite amazing.
Well, the only weakness that was detectable in terms of Hillary Clinton that I noticed was in the last Democratic debate, where both Bernie Sanders and Governor O'Malley did grill her on her connections to Wall Street and her response, saying to associate her support for Wall Street, bringing in the 9/11 issue, was really misfired.
Terrible.
I mean,
that's what I meant by self-inflicted wounds.
Right.
Is that she has verbal missteps, and she is not a great politician. There's no question about that. She's an extremely effective manager and someone who is able to assimilate tremendous amounts of information. But her people skills and her political skills, she can be quite tone deaf.
Well, but she.
But I don't think it's enough to bring her down.
Sure, but how does she handle the fact that she has at her side, or at least some of the time, the world's greatest political campaigner, the guy that idiot Al Gore refused to use in the election that he lost? I mean,
right.
Let's face it, Bill Clinton is a political animal and the great campaigner. How is she going to use him?
She's going to use him heavily.
Uh-huh.
And she'll send him out, and I think he can make a difference. He's got the people skills that she obviously completely lacks, and he revels in the political pressing of the flesh. She's much more remote and aloof. But given the nature of the Republican candidates, I think they will propel her to victory. I don't think she actually needs to be the most exciting candidate. All the ideological fury that the Republicans are expending upon each other makes for entertaining theater, but I don't think it's politically effective.
So what are you hearing then from, I don't even know that I can use the term anymore, traditional Republicans, because they're also running so scared of the Tea Party and being primaried by somebody on their right, that it's very hard to find traditional Republicans in the kind of Howard Baker type mold.
Well, they've been deliberately driven into extinction as far as possible. It's, you know, in the British, you refer to the Wets, and the Republicans have systematically targeted the Wets. They want to be as purist as possible.
Right, the rhinos.
But even John Boehner, who came in with class in 1994, or Paul Ryan, are being described as liberals by the Tea Party people recently.
So is that a permanent situation then, you think? Or
no, I think the interesting question will be, does the Republican Party self-destruct up through to the convention? I mean, are we going to witness the implosion of the GOP, and what will emerge out of the wreckage? Because they seem to be bent on self-destruction right now.
Well, I think to Democrats, this is a very good Thanksgiving message that you're giving us.
Short term. The question is, you need a viable two-party system. What emerges out of this? We just don't know. And the Republicans control, they're not able to function on the national level, but on the state level, they do very well.
Well, that's something that I don't think the Democrats even have a strategy to reverse, the domination of state legislatures and governorships by the Republicans.
Well, you did see inklings in Pennsylvania, for example. The electorate did vote in Democratic judges who determine the contours of the state legislature, of the districts. So that's where the Democrats you know, they need to, they're starting to focus more on the states. It's a 10-year project. I mean, it's very interesting because you have a combination of a country that's becoming more progressive, and then you have a recalcitrant rear guard that has managed to manipulate the electoral process. I don't know if you saw, there was even a piece last week, Politico, about how the Koch brothers have created a secret spying unit to monitor the left and liberal organizations to help discover what they're doing, how they're spending their money, and how they can counteract it.
No, indeed. I did an interview with Ken Vogel about that. But tell me, though, just in the last couple of minutes, what are Republicans telling you? I know that electorally they're an endangered species, the so-called moderate Republican.
Well, I know two sets of Republicans. I know the establishment, and then I know some of the Tea Party types. And the Tea Party types are loaded for bear. They are convinced that they are on the verge of a historic triumph, and that you need to, as the Bolsheviks or Marxists would say, heighten in the contradictions. That the more inflamed the situation becomes, the more they can profit politically. The establishment Republicans are distraught and wringing their hands because they are convinced that the party could suffer a historic loss in the next election, not simply losing the presidency, but also the Senate to the Democrats. So if the party loses another presidential election, it'll be interesting to see if what happens. Can the establishment, which is pretty weak, or regroup, or do we see an effort to create a libertarian Republican Party? I don't know what's coming. I don't think anyone really does. The old formula for the Republican Party, the Bush formula, seems to have exhausted itself, where you promise tax cuts to the wealthy and then camouflage it with a culture war. That just doesn't seem to be selling as well anymore. People want the real thing now.
Well, Jacob Halbrin, I thank you very much for joining us on this Thanksgiving. I appreciate your time with us today, and have a happy Turkey Day.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jacob Halbrin, who is a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times, a senior editor at the New Republic, and a Japan Society fellow. This is Beam Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another background briefing. But in the meantime, if you're not already stuffed with turkey, have a happy Thanksgiving. Bye for now.